I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. Last November, Colorado and Washington State legalized small amounts of marijuana for recreational use. In late August, the Justice Department said it wouldn't block those laws if the states instituted robust regulation and enforcement. At a hearing earlier this week, a deputy attorney general told the Senate Judiciary Committee that the department expects the same from the 18 states that have legalized medical marijuana. Federal law prohibits the growth, sale, and possession of marijuana, which has put the federal government on a strange collision course with the states. It's our topic for this hour of Radio Times, and we begin with David Mark, who's been covering this issue as editor-in-chief of Politics, and that's Politics with an X. And David Mark, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
So where does the public stand today when it comes to marijuana? And, of course, we're talking about recreational marijuana on one hand and medical marijuana on the other. Any way to read where the public stands?
Polls show that public support for legalizing marijuana, either outright or for medical purposes, is a bit over 50%. That's generalizing, but we're seeing a lot of consistent patterns, and as you just noted, the fact that 18 states or so, plus a couple more, have outright legalized it, show there is a trend toward marijuana acceptance, and if not outright legalization, people don't really want law enforcement resources spent on fighting marijuana possession, growth, etc. So I'd say overall a grudging, slow but steady acceptance of marijuana use.
It is interesting to see how the Justice Department, the federal government, is dealing with these changing attitudes towards marijuana and, of course, these changing laws in various states.
Right. The federal government has been a bit flummoxed here. They really don't know what to do because marijuana use remains strictly prohibited under the Controlled Substances Act of 1934, which bans substances like cocaine and heroin and other such drugs that don't have as many advocates. But then you have states kind of going their own way. And in a lot of cases with the states, there's a profit motive involved. They need tax revenues, particularly in these sluggish economic times. And states particularly, in many cases, have turned toward pot growth as a way of bringing in revenue. Even if they don't say it that way overtly, they're really looking to it for economic reasons as much as anything else.
Well, and the Justice Department is trying to figure out how to address these various changes. I guess taking what you've described, others have described as a trust but verify approach.
Right. There's a lot of leeway in the approach that the federal authorities are taking at this point. They're essentially saying the states can allow for some kind of marijuana regimen where it can be, quote-unquote, legalized. People can use it, can grow it, can have some sort of business with it, but only if they don't allow, under certain provisions. It can't be allowed to go to minors. It can't be allowed to be trafficked to states where it is illegal. It can't be used, grown, et cetera, on federal property. So that leaves a lot of discretion up to federal prosecutors, and each U.S. attorney has a lot of discretion how to enforce that. And just because the Justice Department, under Attorney General Eric Holder, has this interpretation, doesn't mean the next Attorney General couldn't view things wildly different. It could be much more stringent under, presumably, a Republican administration. It could be more lenient under a Democratic administration, although even those labels, I think, are becoming tougher to quantify because this issue, in many ways, is all over the map.
Well, and it's interesting because it seems the Obama administration, Justice Department, has come under some criticism, and I don't think just from Democrats, about how tough it has been on marijuana dispensaries in various parts of the country.
Right. The challenge that even, I think, a lot of these quote-unquote drug warriors, those who still want to keep marijuana illegal and prohibited and an illicit substance, face is, just like prohibition in the 1920s, there are not enough federal resources to go after marijuana possession. Even if the next attorney general wanted to make this a high priority, it just wouldn't be feasible. So I think part of it is just a reality check on the part of the Justice Department. And it's an issue that the next attorney general is going to have to face to an even greater degree, having to make some kind of accommodation to it. Even if they don't personally like it or support the policy, it's just the reality, particularly in these tough, strained economic times with budget cutbacks.
Does it complicate things in that we have a president who is admitted to pot smoking?
Well, in a sense, we've had three presidents who have, to one degree or another, admitted. President Obama maybe more overtly by saying it in his memoir, but we had President George W. Bush and Bill Clinton who admitted kind of obliquely that they experimented with drugs in their youth. So I don't think it's much of an issue in that case. If anything, it might be held against a presidential candidate for not trying something, experimenting when they were younger. So I don't think that's so much of an issue. It is interesting, though, that President Obama has come up squarely against marijuana legalization. He was at a conference of the Americas. He was in Colombia, I believe it was last year, the last couple of years, and he was asked the question, not surprisingly, about legalizing marijuana. He said, no, I'm against it. I would think that may change in the coming years, where we're going to have presidential candidates who are more favorable to it, more open, and even into legalization. It may take a couple of more election cycles, but kind of like gay marriage, I do think this issue is heading in that direction.
I mean, it is hard to enforce a law that, you know, most people don't believe in, or half of the people don't believe in, and are in a certain way like speeding laws. You know, it's just hard to enforce them 100%.
Right. It's so different from state to state, and what it does, though, it kind of leaves this lever over states where even if they think they've legalized it, federal authorities can still swoop in at any time and say, ha-ha, you thought it was illegal, but we're going to bust you. And that's happened in Washington State, where it is, quote-unquote, legal, where voters approved it for recreational use just last November. There still have been pot raids. So it leads to all kinds of complications where even a lot of pot dispensaries cannot really operate as legitimate businesses because they can't get bank loans, et cetera. And so it just leaves it in this kind of netherworld. And I suspect the coming administrations are really going to have to confront this as an issue. And I suspect in the next presidential campaign, it's going to become more of a major issue than it has in the past, because you have this hodgepodge of state laws that are being enforced drastically differently. And it just doesn't really work that way as far as federal law goes.
And I would assume states that are looking to balance their budgets, that this is a potential source of real revenue.
It is. And I think that's been a major driving force in many states trying and aiming to legalize marijuana to one degree or another. Sometimes it's gone too far. You actually had the city of Oakland, California, that tried to use a city-owned warehouse as a pot dispensary, and this was early in the Obama administration, and the Justice Department under Attorney General Eric Holder sent them a series of warning letters saying, we will arrest city officials and send them to jail, because there was no way the Justice Department was going to have a major American city acting as a pot dispensary. So that was a little bit brazen. But you have states like Colorado and Washington that part of their argument is that this brings in tax revenue, and it's regulated. You can only grow a certain amount of plants per area. You can only sell in certain amount of doses. There's a real state bureaucracy set up in both places to varying degrees to oversee this. And the Seattle Police Department has even hired a blogger to explain what's legal, what's not, and kind of put it in layman's terms. And states are expecting a lot of revenue. I think some of that is overblown, because a lot of the current cost of marijuana is based on the fact that it's an illicit, illegal drug, and it's marked up for that reason. If it were over-the-counter, you might say, the price would go down, and that would mean less tax revenue for the states.
Since California led the way on this, you're in California, aren't you, David?
That's right. In Northern California, not too far away from the epicenter of some of these marijuana cultivation centers.
In fact, we're going to be talking with a guest about that a little bit later on in the program. But I was reading about in California where there were concerns that people would buy medical marijuana and then essentially sell it on the street to make money. How big of a problem do you think that is in California?
It's interesting. It's been a bit of a problem, but not as much as one would expect. It's almost like people kind of respected the spirit of the law, in that you have a lot of recreational users, but they seem to mostly keep it within the medical marijuana dispensaries. It's not that they go out and and sell it in large quantities. I do think, though, that is a concern with states like Colorado and Washington, where it's just open for recreational use. You can just get it because you want to use it for your own enjoyment. But you can have dealers coming from, you know, Jersey or Florida or wherever it might be, bulking up, getting their supplies, and then reselling it at a higher price. That leads to cartels, it leads to black markets, distortions of prices, sadly criminal activity, et cetera. So I think that's probably more of a concern in states where it's open, it's legally open in outright, like Colorado and Washington, but it's something to be certainly watched in California.
Do you think other states, because it seems that the states that have either legalized it for medical use or recreational use probably are a little more lean liberal. Do you think other states will be following suit, or are they a little more conservative on this issue?
It's interesting. It's not an issue that cuts left and right as much as many others. You actually do have some Republicans who are in favor of this. There is a bill or a couple of pieces of legislation in Congress that have been introduced. Don't have many sponsors in the House of Representatives, 10 or 12 out of 435. But one of the proponents is Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of California, otherwise conservative Republican, who's in favor of pot use. You had, interestingly enough, before they retired last year, the most prominent proponents were Congressman Barney Frank, Democrat of Massachusetts, and Ron Paul, Libertarian Republican of Texas, ideological opposites on both sides. They're both off the political scene now, so it's interesting to see who will pick up the mantle. But I do think there is more broad acceptance of this. And even in that Senate hearing that was noted earlier on, you did have some Republican senators sounding somewhat sympathetic to the states about how this was going to be enforced and whether this was really an effective use of federal law enforcement resources.
Dave, we're almost out of time here, about a minute, but we have spoken to you in the past when you were former senior editor at Politico. Now you're covering pot for Politics with an X. Are the politics of pot that much different from politics in general?
It's interesting. You really do see more of a libertarian strain here, and this is one of our users' favorite issues. I suppose that's not too surprising. We're very much a discussion user-based website where we're trying to tease out and induce high-minded political conversation, and people are really interested in this, and a lot of people who are otherwise rather conservative just say, you know what, let's not bother with this. Let's use the police for getting bad guys, thieves, real criminals who are a threat to society. And that seems to be a strain running through the conversation. So I think that's where it's going in large part.
Well, as always, David Marks, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. He's editor-in-chief of Politics, and he has been covering and we have been talking about some of the changing attitude and politics and policies related to marijuana, our hour in this hour of Radio Times. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be talking about the industry, the business of marijuana after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Elizabeth House supports WHYY and announces the first annual Workforce Opportunities Conference, Wednesday, September 25th at the Chase Center on the Riverfront in Wilmington. The conference links those searching for traditional employment, contract work, small business ventures, and volunteer opportunities with business and government employers, staffing agencies, and educational institutions. Sponsored in part by the Company Corporation. To register online, events.theelizabethhouse.org.
What can you do when your township sprays toxins to control weeds? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss your options when frogs and toads are looking at you to be their Batman. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now...
Hands off Syria! Hands off Syria!
There have been some protests against a U.S. military strike in Syria, but we ask peace activist Tom Hayden where the anti-war effort stands. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. 20 states plus D.C. have legalized marijuana for medicinal and recreational use, which has created market and business opportunities and challenges. Eleazar Melendez has been writing about the marijuana industry for the Huffington Post, and he joins us on Radio Times. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. How would you describe the marijuana industry, to use that term?
It's $100 billion industry, essentially. Not only is it an industry about the cultivation of it, but you have all the people that are manufacturing products, that are getting into the business of marketing it, of being able to distribute it to different places and so forth. And investors are taking note. It's difficult because of the federal prohibition for them to out and out be, you know, putting out IPOs and so forth in terms of the companies that they're supporting, but it is happening, and there's a lot of money going into it.
Are advertising agencies, for instance, lining up to market brands of marijuana in the states where it's legal?
None of them openly so at the moment. It is complicated in the marketplace because, for example, billboard operators are generally quite conservative, and they don't want to put anything on their billboards that might offend their communities. Where they're operating, there's actually still a federal law in the books that says that advertising in a newspaper is essentially being an accessory to the crime. So that's it's actually a crime, which is why you only see advertising occurring in, say, alternative weekly newspapers and so forth. But people are looking at it, and smaller, maybe not Madison Avenue players, are specifically focusing on delivering services to the industry. One thing that is pretty unique to it is the fact that in many states, for the medical part of it, the arrangement is such that the corporations running it are structured as nonprofit corporations, right? Mm. Which means that they can't have a profit going to an owner, which means that when they have money left over from salaries and operations and so forth, they have to spend it, which means there's a lot of money for them to do things like advertising.
I wonder about the Internet. I mean, certainly anyone that's looking at an alternative weekly or magazine has seen some references to marijuana. Do you see the Internet as a way to so-called get out the word?
Absolutely, and that is where they're migrating for the most part. There's some problems with that, with the fact that Google being essentially the largest conduit for advertising on the Internet doesn't allow, through its AdWords platform, which is extremely popular for words related to marijuana, to be linked to specific searches. So if I search for, you know, marijuana or getting high or something like that, I'm not going to be able to see an ad on the AdWords side as I normally would with some other searches. However, other than that, it's open game, and again, it's an interesting kind of entrepreneur that's in this industry. I've been talking to people who are coming in now, who've been there. There's a combination of activism and entrepreneurship that you kind of need to be involved. And you have to be a specific kind of person, a person that's willing to take a lot of risks, with the understanding that this is essentially still a federal crime, to support it in any way, while at the same time not really be out there and you know, kind of like blowing cover and taking easy in how you approach things.
Well, in fact, as I said at the top of the hour, according to the federal government, the law prohibits the growth, sale, and possession of marijuana. And here we are talking about states that have legalized it for medicinal use, for recreational use. There's a tax code, according to what I read in some of what you have written, that dispensaries are seen as narco traffickers. I mean, that's how the federal tax code looks at dispensaries.
Correct. There's a tax issue that they have that actually lobbyists in Washington for the marijuana industry are trying to address at the moment, an old provision in the tax code, which says that anything that they do, because it's still drug trafficking in the eyes of the federal government can't be deducted from the taxes in the part where they're going, even if they're certified by the state as a legitimate medical dispensary, and even if they're a big business employing lots of people. This is an issue for them, obviously, because that means that their tax rate is effectively 10-20% higher than a similar business would be with similar expenses, and it's something that they're lobbying to work on. Beyond that, it's really an issue of the fact that the government, even as it has moved with things like what happened earlier a couple weeks ago in terms of the Obama administration right. saying, you know, we're going to allow the regime for recreational marijuana to be allowed in Washington and Colorado, even when they say that, and even when they say things like we're not going to be cracking down on the banks and whatnot, for lending and sending capital to medical marijuana dispensaries and other people in the industry, no one really knows if that's actually going to be enforced. No one really knows if the next president is going to, you know, turn his back on that and say, well, you know, the last president made that through executive order, but it's still the law, so I'm changing that now. And there is a precedent for the government, even the Obama administration, not really being too forceful, making the statement that they're going to support this and then not being too forceful on it. Well, that precedent being the famous Auchin memo,
yes.
where they basically told, essentially they told various people in states where dispensaries were, that, you know, you can go ahead and allow them to move forward, and it's at your discretion if they meet these standards, that you don't really have to enforce them, and you can cooperate and work with local authorities to determine, you know, go after the really bad guys and leave the people that are following the rules alone. But then specific federal prosecutors became de facto drug czars in different states and decided to disregard that and still prosecute people that were following state rules for medical marijuana dispensary. So it's a complicated system based on the fact that it is still a crime at the federal level.
And I would assume not the kind of climate that business necessarily wants to get involved in.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and Google and Facebook are not going to be starting major marijuana investment divisions or going into huge spots with that. There is a possibility that venture capital, smaller investors pooling money together could focus on this. A lot of the companies that are deciding to raise money are using the provisions of the Jobs Act to raise money through IPOs that are fairly simple to do. Again, it's also an interesting point in time because you have this weird, complicated climate, but it's also at the same time something that you can sell to investors and people that want to participate in the industry as a sexy growth industry. So you actually have quite a bit of hucksterism and people mm-hmm. coming in to boost things that they might not really have. So it's complicated. You can't really just trust anyone that says, "Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and establish a major marijuana empire and be like, okay, here's my money."
Well, let me reintroduce you, and we're hoping that your phone line will stay with us, Eleazar. Talking with Eleazar Melendez, he's been writing about the marijuana industry for the Huffington Post. We're spending this hour talking about marijuana because some 20 states have legalized it, 2 for recreational use, 18 for medicinal use, and of course, District of Columbia as well, raising a whole host of questions about what the federal government is or isn't going to do, how states are looking at marijuana as a possible source of tax revenue, and what questions it raises about advertising and business. And we're interested in your questions and comments. And then again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Eleazar, talk about a huckster. You write about a guy named Brian. I can't pronounce his last name. He's the president of something called Prohibition Brands. Who is this guy?
It's basically a guy that has decided that he wants to go around the country saying that he's going to raise millions of dollars in order to establish this brand that he's calling the future of Marlboro weed or the future of Anheuser commercial weed. You know, he has his right and to say what he wants, and it's interesting because it's part of the Jobs Act, right? This law that was passed in order to allow companies to raise money without having to answer as many questions to the SEC as they had in the past. you can literally just file an application with the Securities and Exchange Commission that says, I have some idea that I'm not going to detail at the moment, and I'm going to start selling to investors. So this is allowed in the law. It's not illegal for him to do that. But at the same time, it causes unrest and uncertainty in terms of how much experience this guy actually has. He's someone that had a startup when he was in college that was related to technology, so he has some experience running a company, but he doesn't really have any real experience in the marijuana industry or in production or distribution of marijuana as some of the other people that are in the industry. So it raises a lot of eyebrows when people like that say, could come in and say, I'm going to start the Marlboro weed, because that's something that a lot of people have been talking about for a long time. No one really has a claim to be able to do it until they basically do it. So it's kind of complicated. There's another gentleman, Jamin Chesley, that is creating what he said. He's going to be like the Starbucks of pot. And he's going to form retail chains, he says, in Colorado and Washington now that it's legal. He has rights to a shop in Washington State. No one really knows, because he hasn't made details clear about what's happening next, but we do know that he's going around the country as well with different press conference soliciting investors and so forth.
Let me quote something that you say about this Brian guy. He takes on the guise of a stereotypical cowboy to woo financiers, aided by two skimpily clad female models and a puppet horse. He discusses the green rush of investment in marijuana. I mean, that seems kind of, I don't know, kind of 70s, if I can say that.
Sure. What's interesting, too, is that a lot of people that are actually making businesses that are actually making a lot of profit in the industry are people that are saying, look, there's a lot of interest in this and there's a lot of ways to make money, but perhaps touching the actual plant might be a little too risky. Mm-hmm. So some of the most successful ventures that have risen out of the growing marijuana industry have been web ventures, for example, to help people find information about dispensaries and strains and whatnot. Two of the most notable ones are a site called weedmaps.com, which is sort of a Google Maps for weed dispensaries, if you will. And then another site called Leafly, which is kind of a Yelp. They rate dispensaries and they rate strains and they give people access to information. And those ventures are, as far as I understand it, the owners of them claim them to be profitable and growing. Another thing that's happening right now is a lot of people are focusing on what's going to be the standard marijuana container when it becomes legal. What's going to be the 20-ounce bottle or the kind of like wrapper that people are going to use as a cheap standard thing in the future that's going to substitute the dime bag that a lot of people get as a way to deliver their cannabis. And say, for example, delivering a plastic container that's childproof and sunproof, doesn't get damaged by UV ray, and cheap and disposable is a market that if anyone gets that, they'll truly make a lot of money.
Well, I'm looking at one of the headlines of one of your stories going back to June. Marijuana vending machines, stoner fantasy may become industry norm. Was that just a headline writer having fun, or do you think there's the possibility of a marijuana vending machine?
There's companies working on the concept. At the time, the biggest one is this company called Metbox in Arizona, and it's not really a vending machine the way that you would have like a Cheetos or a Coca-Cola vending machine where the public accesses. It's kind of a way for people working inside the dispensaries to maintain logistics and product control and whatnot, because they press a button and all the information comes out and then you get dispensed. There are other companies working on a more explicit vending machine concept, and it would be kind of like the automat concept from the 80s and early 90s, where you go into a room and it's a locked room, and you swipe a card that has your information and you get it, and it is a possibility. No one really knows exactly what the experience of buying marijuana will be once it becomes more fully effective and legal. Right now, for most people, they go into a dispensary in California or Colorado, and the general attitude is like you come in And after you go through security, there's these huge jars behind the counter, and there's a so-called butt tender that helps you select your strain, gives you information, lets you smell it, lets you touch it sometimes, cuts it for you, sends it to you, and then you're on your way. That's very similar to, say, how general stores worked in the first half of the 20th century, which, needless to say, is not the most effective way for a retailer to work. A lot of people in the industry are kind of nostalgic for that and say, like, look, now I want something that's such a specific product that you kind of need that format to work in that specific way because people need to have that their handheld for the whole process. Other people are saying, why isn't it more like the Apple Store? Why isn't there like a sample in the front that you then get dispensed through a tube or some kind of thing that makes it much more automated and efficient? So as it becomes a thing that happens in more states and as it becomes more widely accepted, obviously the experience of marijuana of buying marijuana is going to change tremendously. The same way it's gone from essentially something that you buy in the street corner to then going to a brick and mortar shop and getting it.
Well, again, we're talking about marijuana. We're talking about the fact that a number of states have legalized it, but the federal government says that the growth of sale and possession of marijuana is against the law. And Eliezer, another sort of interesting little angle as part of this story is that as far as the government is concerned, even labels that I guess play with some of these that are associated with illegal drugs, including marijuana, from the perspective of the federal government, that those are illegal, and yet you have a piece here about some of these beer breweries that are playing with some of the label ideas.
That was a fun story to go into and fun to talk to the people that are involved in that. Basically, it's kind of mind-blowing, but also instructive to what the experience is going to be for the federal government for the industry dealing with the federal government if and when cannabis is fully legalized. Because alcohol at one point in this country was completely illegal, when prohibition ended and regulations were put in place, there are a lot of commercial speech restrictions and other restrictions that wouldn't apply to any other product, basically. And one of the things that they say is that for beer labels and liquor labels, they cannot reference any other illicit drug. A lot of people that are in the industry and a lot of people that are enthusiasts and fans of and activists in the realm of marijuana legalization find this a little bit mind-blowing in the sense that they say, how is it possible that a nearly harmless drug is banned from the label of a highly harmful chemical like alcohol? But that's just the case. And it's funny because people do want to use it as branding, do feel that there's a culture and a type of consumer that responds to this type of branding, but the federal government has an agent sitting in an office in Washington saying you can't have Kush or any kind of like name that reflects a marijuana strain be on the label or be the name of your beer. You can't say that your beer is smells like weed. You can't say anything like that because it's still an illicit drug. Mm-hmm. And again, it goes back to the fact that under the law, marijuana at the federal level is still illegal, so you're going to have different branches of the federal government interpreting what that means for what they cover in different ways.
And we have to end on that note. Eliezer Melendez, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's been writing about the marijuana industry, such as it is for Huffington Post. Coming up next, how unregulated growers of marijuana are harming the environment. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
One in three families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Dear Lord, please let this date be good. May he have the wealth of Mayor Bloomberg, the personality of Jon Stewart, the face of Michael Fassbender.
On the next Fresh Air, Mindy Kaling. Her Fox series, The Mindy Project, starts its second season Tuesday. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
An opening or a stall tactic? Can the UN Security Council come up with a resolution that moves forward on Syria's civil war?
It's going to be a very delicate balance between the use of force and diplomacy. The two have to be married.
Former UN Ambassador Nancy Soderbergh. What can make this unforeseen opportunity stick in the Security Council? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. The growing popularity and legalization of marijuana has put pressure on the environment as more people get involved in growing it. Jesse Hyde, our third guest, wrote about its impact in Northern California for The Atlantic in an article titled California's New Pot Growers, Not at All Earth Friendly. He lives in Salt Lake City. His work has appeared in The Atlantic, Rolling Stone, Details, and Men's Journal. And Jesse Hyde, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And to our listeners, any questions or comments you might have, again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Jesse, you wrote about this part of California that's called the Emerald Triangle. It's in Northern California. Describe this part of the country for us.
Yeah, so this is near the Redwoods National Forest. So, you know, it's beautiful country, towering sequoias. And the Emerald Triangle is named that for three counties, Humboldt County, Mendocino, and Trinity counties. And since the late 60s, early 70s, this has become the most popular place in America to grow marijuana. In fact, it produces more marijuana than anywhere else in the U.S., and it sustains the entire economy there. It's it's estimated to be a $1 billion industry. You talk to some growers who say it's even more than that. So at this point it really touches every facet of life for people who live there.
And I'm assuming back in the 60s we're talking about the hippies growing it illegally, perhaps for themselves, perhaps for sale. But now we're talking about California, which has legalized medicinal marijuana, and other states as well. How has that changed, this agriculture in Northern California?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in the 60s and 70s, it was a totally different environment, at least in terms of marijuana, than it is today, where you had, they call them, you know, homestead growers, people who were kind of looking to go, you know, back to the land, and they saw marijuana sort of a sacrament of the earth. So they had this really close relationship with the plant, saw it sort of in a medicinal way. And over time, that changed, primarily in the mid-90s when California passed what's called Proposition 215, where they legalized marijuana for medicinal purposes. And at that point, the industry just exploded. And so you had this huge influx of people from out of state who started to try to cash in. And because there was land there and because it already sort of had this culture, this kind of outlaw hippie culture, it became the place where if someone wanted to get into the business, that's where they went.
But as you describe, and others have as well, we're talking about, toxic materials, fertilizers, polluted water. Help us understand the negative impact that these speculators have had on the environment.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, you have two different kind of grows. One is the grow that is in a national park, and these are primarily cartel grows. So you'll have a Mexican cartel that's financing it. They'll send people up, and these are really remote, and these wreak incredible damage on the environment because they'll bring up pesticides and fertilizers, some that are illegal in the U.S. And then you have another kind of grow, which is called a trespass grow, which might be closer to a city. And these are typically, you know, someone who's basically like a speculator. They call it the green rush, so similar to California's gold rush. These are people who came in to cash in on this new industry. In both cases, what you'll have is bulldozer will come in, clear the land. In some cases, they're toppling trees that are been there 100 years. And then they'll dam up streams. You'll have pesticides trickling into streams. In some cases, you'll have human waste trickling into streams. And so it's had a big impact on the wildlife there, on salmon, on other mammals, even songbirds that will run into these fences they put up to dry marijuana. It rusts, and then the birds can't see them. they're flying through. And so it's had a pretty far-reaching impact that I think people are just starting to grapple with in California.
How do you get a bulldozer or bulldozers into a park? I mean, I know these are big parks, and there are probably many areas that are, you know, hard to reach, but nonetheless, it's sort of hard to imagine something as brazen as that taking place in a national park.
Yeah, so with the bulldozers, those would be more like on a trespass grow. So we're talking like unincorporated land in one of these counties. You know, you just go off a dirt road, and you know, there's a lot of land and it's really remote. So, you know, someone rents a bulldozer, hires somebody, they come in and they clear out some land and they put up their grow. You know, the people that have been there for the last 10 years, they're amazed at how much things have changed just in the last year or so, where it's just, you know, you said brazen. It's so out in the open. I talked to one of the guys who's really been on top of this. He's a scientist with the California Department of Fish and Game. He says when he flies over the Emerald Triangle like in a helicopter, he'll see marijuana farms like just in rows, orchards, massive warehouses. And there's no one who's trying to hide it at all. Even though it's kind of in this tricky, you know, gray space where federally it's illegal. So every once in a while you have a big federal bust on one of these grows. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, people aren't afraid of it at all. It's incredibly brazen.
And it's very water intensive, right, to grow marijuana?
Yeah, I mean, they've estimated that, you know, in one watershed alone, some of these growers have diverted 18 million gallons of water. So that's one of the other big environmental impacts is you have these streams that are home to endangered fish, primarily a fish called a coho salmon, and they'll divert water to irrigate their marijuana crop from streams that already have a low water table because, as you know, California is in the midst of a drought. And so, yeah, they're just illegally diverting it to these marijuana farms and has an impact on, you know, these salmon and where they spawn.
I was also surprised to read in your piece about something like a third of the growers are growing them indoors, I guess, in some form of a greenhouse?
Yeah, so that could be, you know, and that's not just in the Emerald Triangle. I mean, that's down in Oakland, down in L.A. There's just a huge indoor scene. And part what's ironic here is that a lot of the laws that essentially were sort of prohibition-type laws pushed growers inside. So, you know, we talked about in the 60s or 70s when the Emerald Triangle became known as sort of this pothead Shangri-La. It's like the place you go to grow marijuana. There was a big crackdown. And so initially guys who grew outdoors, they went inside so they wouldn't get arrested. And they really perfected the art of growing, you could call it artisanal weed. And now that's kind of the industry standard in California. You know, if you go into some of these really big dispensaries, there's one in Oakland called Harborside, 80% of the marijuana sold there comes from indoor grows. It's rare to be able to buy something that's outdoor grown. And, you know, that's, in terms of electrical usage, it's huge. There's some estimates that it's 9% of California's household electricity use.
And just to keep the lights on, I guess, right?
Right, yeah, because if you're going indoors, you know, you don't have the sun, so it's all under grow lamps. And so, you know, that has another environmental impact in terms of, you know, you're talking about coal, you're talking about climate change. And so I think as California and other states start to kind of grapple with, you know, like Washington and Oregon, what does it mean to legalize? These are some impacts that I'm not sure they had really thought through. And, you know, California has started to grapple with this, but some of these other states, I'm not sure if they know what they're in for.
Because it's, I think supporters would say it's, you know, it's natural, and that's one of the selling points for it. But what you're really describing, and this certainly in various parts of California, is the environmental degradation from these illegal growers.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that is the perception we have. And when I started to research this piece, that was one of the things that surprised me, because I had always had this image of the Emerald Triangle as, you know, like you said, sort of this hippie paradise, and everything is very organic. And that still exists. I mean, you talk to growers who have been there, there are second, even third-generation growers who are actually upset about what's happening in the Emerald Triangle. And they do grow in a sustainable way. But, you know, it's a place to look at because, like I said, you have all these people who have come in from out of state, and they don't have that attitude about the earth. For them, this is purely a cash crop, and they're looking to be able to turn around a profit as quickly as possible.
And that's Jesse Hyde, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, taking three different perspectives on marijuana. He's a writer. He lives in Salt Lake City, and he wrote a piece recently for The Atlantic that caught our eye. It's called California's New Pot Growers, Not at All Earth Friendly. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jesse, you talked about some of these cartels that have then moved into these national parks. Are these cartels from, you know, from Mexico or Central America, other parts of the world?
Yeah, mostly from Mexico. And so basically what will happen is they will send someone who tends to this farm. And when law enforcement have come across some of these grows, you know, in remote spots in big national forests, they've noticed that in some cases they wonder if they've had someone living there for, you know, a year or more. You know, they've found sheds. They find sort of empty, you know, stockpiles of food. And so basically these guys come up and they're watering the plant. They're trimming it. They're harvesting it. And so it's a pretty sophisticated operation.
And as you said, for those people that are concerned about the impact on the environment, are they organized enough to sort of push back against these unregulated growers?
Yeah, they've started to. I mean, it's interesting because historically the Emerald Triangle has had, you know, sort of this to a certain extent, an outlaw culture in which you don't rat on your neighbors because they're doing something illegal too. And so people have kept quiet about it. But over time, as more people moved in from outside and, you know, would dump diesel, accidentally spill diesel into a creek or dump pesticides into a creek, dam up some waterways, then people who've been there for a long time said, you know, this is something we need to speak up against. And so you're starting to see that happen where there's this grassroots movement of second-generation growers who are saying, this isn't what this area has historically been about, and we can grow in a sustainable way. We need to do that. But the people who don't, you know, sort of want to comply with that, they're worried that if they talk with the county water regulators, things like that, and they're putting a target on their back for federal law enforcement. So there's still this tendency to want to sort of stay under the radar.
And one of the things we've been talking about during this hour is this tension then between states that have legalized marijuana and the federal government that still sees it as a legal drug. And it's interesting that growers are feeling that tension as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for law enforcement, it makes it really difficult because, you know, there are these competing regulations. And so you talk to some of these growers who are involved in kind of a grassroots movement to stem this tide of environmental degradation. And, you know, what they say is we'll talk to growers who say, I want to follow the rules, but I just don't know, you know, who I check in with to do that. And if I do talk to someone at the county, you know, eventually is that going to get me in trouble?
Are the marijuana growers that are in these parks and, you know, leveling hilltops and perhaps even cutting down trees, are they a threat to the forest there in Northern California?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest environmental impact right now is the water, the electrical use, and also the impact it's had on certain species of wildlife. I mentioned earlier the coho salmon, but there's another mammal in the forest. It's called a Pacific fisher. It's like a weasel sort of animal, and it eats a lot of the bait they put out, and so they found a lot of these carcasses of this mammal in the forest too. In terms of the trees, I mean, it has an impact because they're clearing a lot of forest and they're doing it illegally, but I don't know if that's as big of an impact as the water use and the impact on some of these you know, endangered species.
Are there itinerant pot workers, and by that I mean people that sort of go from farm to farm or place to place harvesting marijuana?
Yeah. So what's interesting is when they've looked at who owns a lot of these illegal grows, a big chunk of them are people who come from out of state, and they actually can't trace it back to who actually owns the land. And what they'll do is they'll hire people who just come in for the grow season to help harvest. And so if you drive through the area, you'll see people around that time standing on the road, you know, kind of looking for work where they can go, and they call it clipping and bagging. or helping with the harvest. And so, you know, what happens is they're there for that season, and then they take off to, you know, it might be Costa Rica, and they surf for the winter, and they're back again. So it's a demographic of, like, you know, it's a lot of college-age kids, and it's sort of like a summer job for them to come and help on these grows, and then they take off.
What got you interested in this topic?
I've covered drug-related stories for quite a while, and so this was interesting to me because it's a different aspect. And living in the West, you see how, and especially in California where I do a lot of reporting, you see how, you know, marijuana is really changing the culture. And I had just finished a story actually in British Columbia where that had kind of been, you know, the equivalent we have to the Emerald Triangle basically in Canada. And this was an area that I'd never really explored and hadn't really thought about. But it makes sense that it would have this environmental impact, because I think the fact that it's illegal, it just makes it really hard to regulate.
Well, and I guess that, and we're almost out of time here, but that really is the issue. So you've got these, you know, these federal laws, you've got the, I guess the EPA could get involved just to complicate things even further as we try to figure out what to do about marijuana.
Yeah, so, you know, anytime they have when they find one of these these grows that's causing a lot of environmental damage, I mean, there will be 10 different county or city agencies there, you know, checking on different impacts. And so it's really hard to figure out what to do. And I think for now, for me, the most encouraging sign is that some of these growers have started to stand up to those who are causing the most environmental damage. And for now, that seems like the best solution, because the states, they can't really do anything. So it's tricky.
Well, Jesse Hyde, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, the article that he wrote for The Atlantic is titled California's New Pot Growers Not at All Earth Friendly. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.